It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll get some ideas for cooking with pumpkin.
First, though, a state legislative committee talked about a new bill yesterday that would ban what people are calling revenge porn.
Revenge porn is the practice of posting nude or otherwise explicit photos of an ex-partner on the internet as a way of exacting revenge.
A similar bill was signed into law this month in California with some controversy over whether it provided enough protection to the victims.
Here with us to discuss the proposed measure is the lead sponsor of the bill here in Wisconsin, Republican Assembly Representative John Spiros of Marshfield. Representative Spiros, thanks for joining us. So what was the motivation behind creating this bill?
You know, actually the media was the beginning of it, because the media contacted me and asked me if I had heard anything about revenge porn. And they used that terminology, and I'm like, what are you talking about?
We've had that here, too, when we've mentioned that to some people, yeah.
So I started doing some research. I had Catherine in my office do some research. And actually we talked to a number of people, a number of victims. And we learned quite quickly that this was a concern and something we should take a look at. And we contacted an expert on non-consensual pornography from the University of Miami, Marianne Franks. And she had actually looked at, New Jersey has a law that they've had for about 10 years. And prior to California's bill, this bill was the only one in California, just went into existence. I know Texas and Florida were looking at it, and we had her take a look at our bill to try to make sure that it was strong and that it was something that would hold up if ever contested, things like that. So, we worked with her, and I think we put together a pretty good bill.
I know a group of victims in California were big advocates for the law that was just signed there earlier this month. Did you encounter victims here in Wisconsin when you were looking into this?
I know Senator Buchner, who is the author on the Senate side. I know she has somebody that she knows real well. I think that is a victim. I had talked to a few victims, not actually from our state, but from out of state. As soon as they heard that I was looking into this, they contacted me, talked to me a little bit, talked to Catherine. And you wouldn't believe the support. I mean, you know, and just the contact from them that said, hey, this is a great thing, and we're glad that you're taking it up. Because there's one in Texas that actually had to change her name, and do other things just to protect herself.
Yeah, the idea here is that someone else has put pictures of you on the internet without your consent, and I think in the case you're talking about in Texas, it led to a lot of public harassment and public and online harassment, right?
Right, you're correct.
So, I know California and New Jersey had different approaches. What would the new Wisconsin law do if it passes?
This one also protects people who take the image themselves, or if the image was taken by another person, which I don't believe theirs does. And our law also, I think, when you take a look at it, I know that the question came up yesterday when this was brought up in committee, and actually this bill went in front of the committee yesterday, and the question came up about First Amendment a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's been tried in New Jersey. I think that our bill is stronger than that bill, and I think this will hold up from that standpoint. So that was really one of the main things, though, is protect people who take images themselves. Beyond that, it's as you read earlier when you read part of the bill.
Yeah, so it's not just if someone consents to having a picture taken of them or takes it themselves, that's not an out for someone who's distributing them without their consent. It seems like the key here is the distribution online.
Absolutely, yes.
And so what kind of penalties are we talking about then for distribution of these images without consent?
It's a Class A misdemeanor, a fine punishable up to $10,000.
Okay, so a pretty substantial fine. Why does this need to be a misdemeanor? Is this something that could just be handled under current law in the civil court system?
I know that the issue with civil, though, is really it costs money. From the standpoint of a victim, the victim would have to prove it. And granted, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt like it is in criminal. But still, you have to find an attorney who's willing to take that. And are there, you know, are you going to be able to do anything from the standpoint of whether this was a criminal offense or not? You know, when it gets down to it, I think we wanted to do something that would protect people, but also it's something so that if somebody thinks about it, they're going to think twice before they do it. Because right now there's nothing there. And there's websites out there that ask for pictures and ask for videos and actually asking for this stuff. So, you know, and from our standpoint, that's it's vengeful on both sides. That from the person trying to post it and that from a provider that's actually trying to just, you know, I think capitalize on insulting somebody or hurting them.
Well, and then one of the things the sites do is if you're the victim here and contact them, they say, sure, we'll take it down. Give us your credit card info. Here's what it'll cost you.
Yeah. And even that, I don't know whether that totally works because I've heard from people that basically have said that, you know, they've asked to have it taken off. They've worked on with attorneys and other that, and, you know, and it's just there's nothing there from the law standpoint to help them. So from my point, this is something that will be there. It'll help them. And when you take a look at it, and I know you mentioned about, you know, about the misdemeanor or the $10,000 fine. I think New Jersey, I believe, is a top misdemeanor or the first felony, or it's up to $30,000 fine. So that's pretty stiff there, too. So
there have been criticisms of the laws in other states, as you mentioned, on First Amendment grounds. Does this chill free speech? Could I share an artistic picture someone else took, say, but I don't go to the person who posed for that picture?
And I think that, you know, that question actually came up yesterday. And I think we're looking at it from the standpoint of the victim and whether, you know, something that's public. And if you're out in the public and you know that someone's taking that portrait or whatever else, something that's public, it's a little bit different than something that's not public. But even from the art standpoint, I think there's a real fine line when it comes down to art and distributing art versus taking a look at this. This is really more personal between two individuals typically, and that's where these have come from, rather than somebody painting a picture and putting it in an art gallery.
All right, Representative Spiros, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of State Assembly Representative John Spiros of Marshfield.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with Food Friday. We'll talk about cooking with pumpkins. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
There is a definite chill in the air here in Wisconsin. Fall seems to be in full swing, which means we have pumpkin spice lattes, pumpkin muffins, pumpkin just about everything.
But are we using our pumpkins to their fullest potential? We got a pumpkin expert to fill us in on how to cook with them for this Food Friday. His name is Michael Crondall. He's a food historian and author of The Great Little Pumpkin Cookbook.
Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Well, you've written a whole cookbook about pumpkin, so clearly this is an ingredient that you love. What is it that you like about cooking with pumpkin?
Well, doesn't everybody love pumpkins? I mean, they're cute. They're orange. You don't get them year-round. I don't know. There's just something appealing about them.
What about the flavor? Is it special when you put it up against, say, a squash or something like that?
I'll tell you what it is. It's very specific. The thing about pumpkins that sort of excite me is they're really only available for a few months of the year. And, you know, we're at the point where everything is available year-round so that apples don't really mean fall anymore. They mean any old time. But pumpkins, you can't get a pumpkin in June. You can't get a pumpkin in July. So they still epitomize fall in a way that just no other growing thing almost does.
What kind of pumpkin should we be cooking with? Because I'm guessing you can't just go to your pumpkin patch and get one of the giant ones and happily cook a pumpkin pie with it.
Yeah. There's a bunch of different pumpkins that people grow, and, you know, they grow them for different purposes. So a lot of those really pretty orange pumpkins are grown to be really pretty and orange, and that's about it. They're made specifically with thin walls so that they're easy to carve and turn into jack-o'-lanterns. They're miserable in terms of flavor. It's kind of like trying to eat, you know, I don't know, flowers instead of lettuce. They're not grown for that. There are other pumpkins, though, that are specifically grown to eat rather than to cut up into jack-o'-lanterns. The most common of these is something called a cheese pumpkin. Here in Wisconsin, right, you know about things like cheese.
I know about cheese. I've never heard of a cheese pumpkin
cheese
before.
Cheese pumpkin. And it looks like it looks a little bit like a Gouda cheese, which is why they call it a cheese pumpkin. It doesn't actually taste anything like a cheese. But it's sort of round and kind of tan in color on the outside. But you cut into it, and it's got thick walls, so there's a lot of pumpkin in there. And it's sort of bright orange on the inside. So from the outside, it's a little bit homely, but on the inside, it's gorgeous.
Nice. So then what do you do once you've got your beautiful cheese pumpkin and you want to do something with it? How do you prepare it and get the puree that you could get a nice, convenient can of?
Well, now, hold on a minute. Puree. There's lots of things you can do with a pumpkin other than just turn it into pumpkin pie. But, of course, you need to buy my book for that. But if you want... Let's answer your question first, and then I'll go on to all the other things you can do with a pumpkin. But one of the things that you need to do if you're going to turn it into puree for like a pumpkin pie is you have to roast it first so it gets mushy, right? So you cut it up, scoop out the seeds, put it in the oven for about 45 minutes to an hour at about 375, 400, and you've got mush. You scoop out the mush, and then you need to let the excess water drain out. So you kind of mash it up a little bit, put it in a colander or put it in a sieve, and then let it drip for a couple of hours. And you'd be amazed how much water comes out of it. And then you've got, you know, your pumpkin puree, just like you might get out of a Libby's can, except it tastes better. And if you have extra, you can freeze it and save it. But, and here's the big but, there's all these other things you can do with a whole pumpkin.
Yeah, what else can we do with it?
One of my favorite things, and you cannot do this with a can of Libby's, is you can scoop the thing out, and you can layer it with toasted bread, sort of a crusty, sort of Italian or French-style crusty bread, cream, and some sort of a slightly stinky cheese, so like Gruyere or a Monterey Jack or something like that. And basically you layer bread, cheese, cream, bread, cheese, cream, with relatively a lot of salt and pepper in it. Then you put the top back on. So you scoop the thing out, right? You fill it with this kind of almost savory bread pudding mixture. You put the top back on, wrap the whole thing in tin foil, and then cook it for about 2 hours at about 400 in the oven. And then you take the tin foil off, and then you mash around. You kind of like mix around all those ingredients that are inside the pumpkin, and you have the most delicious, savory kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think I'm dumbstruck conceptualizing all this cheese and cream and pumpkin
together. Oh, well,
you know,
cheese, cream, and pumpkin, so you've got creamy, cheesy, pumpkin-y, salt, pepper. It's just,
Yeah, that can't be bad.
It's just autumn.
Is that a worthy Thanksgiving side dish, would you say?
Oh, sure, or just do it instead of Thanksgiving.
Is it a dippy thing, or do you just kind of skip it out?
No, it's more like, it would be more like a side dish or possibly a first course. It's more like a bread pudding consistency.
Oh, that sounds yummy. So that's a savory way to go with pumpkin.
Oh, yeah.
Is that your favorite way, or do you like the sweet?
You know what? It depends what you want to do with it. It's in Europe, they use it a lot in a savory preparation. So there's lots of pumpkin soups, and the French do an au gratin with it. So they basically slice it thin and then kind of do it like potatoes. You know, they put butter and again cheese. And bake it so that it's kind of like potatoes au gratin.
So about the pumpkins themselves, now here's a question for you. Are they fruits or are they vegetables?
Well, that's one of those questions. Are you asking a cook or a botanist? A cook will tell you it's a vegetable. A botanist will tell you it's a fruit.
Huh.
You know, you use it like a vegetable, but botanically it's got seeds in it, so it's a fruit. Like a zucchini is a fruit, if you want to call it that. Like a tomato is a fruit, or eggplant is a fruit, but nobody calls those things fruits.
I suppose it doesn't matter when you're in your kitchen. It is what it is. It's tasty.
And you know, and it is remarkable in that, and it, you know, all winter squashes like this, is that you can go either the sweet way or the savory way. You can turn it into dessert, any one of a number of desserts, or you can turn it into these savory preparations, and it's delicious both ways, which is kind of unusual.
So when pumpkin is out of season and, you know, we're not using it as easily, we can't find those sugar pumpkins, if we're looking at a recipe, you know, could we substitute squash and get, you know, more or less the same effect?
Well, you have to realize that a pumpkin is a squash. You know, it's kind of one of those, like, a dachshund is a dog, but a dog isn't a dachshund.
Gotcha.
So a pumpkin is a kind of squash, and there are close relatives. For example, butternut squash was actually developed out of a kind of a pumpkin. So, you know, butternut squash great-grandfather was a pumpkin.
Okay, well, that's a good way to think about it. Is it any more labor-intensive than cooking with, say, a butternut squash?
It depends what you're going to do with it. If you're making soup, butternut squash is probably less work. But if, like, you know, you are using it as a vessel for something, then, of course, you can't use a butternut squash because it doesn't have the nice big hole in it.
Right. Well, you were selling me on these recipes. Do you have another one for us, something that's a little unexpected like that?
When I was doing research on this, I came across these old English recipes because the English took to pumpkins very, very early on. And they would make an apple pie that was a half apple and half pumpkin pie. So they would take the pumpkin, they would peel it and cut it up into pieces, and they would mix it with sliced apples. And then they would bake it like you would a traditional two-crusted apple pie, but it was half pumpkin and half apple. So the pumpkin in there isn't pureed. It's there, in slices.
That sounds yummy. Have you tried that?
Oh, yeah. I think they have a recipe in my book for that.
Excellent. Well, so pumpkin pie, you know, this is the gold standard, I guess, for people at Thanksgiving. They want to have a good pumpkin pie. A lot of people I know just, you know, get the can of Libby's, follow the directions, and that is their pumpkin pie. Now, what would you suggest if we wanted to get, you know, really organic with it and use a real pumpkin? How can we make our pumpkin pie better and step it up with fresh pumpkin?
Well, first of all, there's nothing wrong with Libby's. You know, there are certain canned products which, as long as you just get the pumpkin as opposed to pumpkin pie filling, which is miserable stuff. But if you just get the pumpkin, there's really nothing terrible about it. But if you want to go, you know, one step higher than that, you go to your local farmer's market and get yourself a cheese pumpkin. You cut it in half and you roast the thing out. Roast the thing up. And then scoop it out, make your puree, and then, like I said, you need to let it drain because it's just too watery initially. So you need to let it drain for 2 or 3 hours, and then you've got your pumpkin puree, and you can use that. And it will have a fresher, cleaner flavor compared to a canned product.
And do you do the basic spices that we're used to seeing, your cinnamon, your nutmeg, your allspice, or is there a different spice blend that you found that makes it better?
I like that spice blend just because it's very medieval. When you look at really, really old recipes, all those sweet spices together, the nutmeg, cinnamon, cloves, and ginger, I like to put some ginger in there too, they're kind of what they were serving, you know, on just about every food 300 or 400 years ago. And so for me, it has this kind of, I don't know, tradition behind it that isn't just a tradition of a couple of hundred years, but like goes way back to the Middle Ages.
Wow. Yeah, that is a cool way to think about it. Well, what about the pumpkin seeds? I love pumpkin seeds. It's one of my favorite things about carving a pumpkin. And they're supposed to be nutritional, good for you and healthy. Are you a fan of pumpkin seeds?
I have to confess to being really lazy and just buying shelled pumpkins, which I like. I'll tell you what part of the problem with using that, you know, carving out that pumpkin, using those pumpkin seeds. In the same way that pumpkins are grown specifically to be jack-o'-lantern pumpkins, other pumpkins are grown specifically for their seeds. And those pumpkins have much larger and kind of fleshier seeds. And when you, like, go to a Mexican market and buy pepitas, which are those green, you know, pumpkin seeds, which I love, they're from a different kind of a pumpkin. That's why they're three times the size of the ones that you dig out or the one that you've carved from the jack-o'-lantern. That said, I think the whole process of carving the jack-o'-lantern and then roasting the seeds, there's something lovely about that as well. But then it's more kind of like it's about the process.
So speaking of seasonal, have you also had your first pumpkin spice latte of the season to celebrate?
I am afraid that I'm one of those people that thinks coffee should just taste like coffee.
And you're a purist.
It's not so much that I'm a purist. I don't really like cinnamon or hazelnut. I don't like any of those flavors in my coffee. So I want my pumpkin spice and my pumpkin pie.
All right. Well, we've got lots of fresh inspiration here for pumpkin. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Michael Crondall, food historian, author of The Great Little Pumpkin Cookbook and Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we're talking to a filmmaker about her documentary on the children's classic, The Phantom Tollbooth.
We'll also talk about a haunted hotel in Fond du Lac. WPR sent a producer there. He'll fill us in on his creepy encounters.
And we're talking to the Wisconsin Bicycle Federation about a legislation they're promoting to help protect pedestrians and cyclists.
That's Monday on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we're talking to author and conservative hero Ann Coulter. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up in our next hour, we'll talk about mounting diplomatic tensions over the NSA surveillance of leaders around the world.
First, though, our next guest has been the center of controversy in America since the late 90s when she published her first book, High Crimes and Misdemeanors. She's often polarizing, always irreverent, and she's at it again with her latest book, Never Trust a Liberal Over Three, Especially a Republican. Ann Coulter is the author of 9 New York Times bestsellers. She's a syndicated columnist. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here, Rob. Excellent intro music.
You're a Grateful Dead fan, I heard.
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, let's talk shutdown a little bit. Surrounding the recent shutdown, we had different reactions from Republicans after it ended. Some said the Republican Party was being taken over by Tea Party extremists. Others said Republicans in Congress chickened out, didn't hold out long enough. What's your take on it?
I disagree with both of those. I'm really proud of our guys. And if our party is being taken over by the likes of Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, I say hallelujah. We could use more like them. I think they're probably the two smartest United States senators right now. I love Republicans, but that's kind of rare for us. And I don't know what the point of holding out any longer is. They made their point. I think they got the word out. They've established the Republican Party as the anti-Obamacare party. We're going to fight against this. Just give us a majority in the Senate. And perhaps most importantly, I don't think anybody outside of, I don't know, a dozen of us realized that Congress, after foisting Obamacare on us, instantly issued a waiver to itself. That is perhaps not universally known now, but it's a lot better known, and information does tend to go out in concentric circles. That was the Republicans' last offer. Fine, we will fund the entire government. We will fund Obamacare, but we insist that Congress live under Obamacare themselves. And the Democrats said, no, no, don't make us live under Obamacare.
There's been a narrative going back a long time. You know, we hear nowadays establishment Republicans against Tea Party, but going back to the Goldwater campaign in the 60s or Reagan and Ford in the 70s, there's always this talk, there's this war within the Republican Party tearing it apart. They're still here. Does that narrative get oversold, do you think?
It may. I'm sure the Democrats are delighted when Republicans pull out the internal firing squad. In general, I come down on the side of conservatives. It's been my experience that every time Republicans lose, the liberal Republicans will turn to the conservatives and say, it's your fault, give up your issues. But if you look at our issues when they're voted on individually, gay marriage, that's been voted on by about 36 states. Only 2 or 3, I think, have approved it. So that's more popular than being against gay marriage, rather, is more popular than Republicans are. Obamacare has consistently had a majority of Americans opposed to it, and I don't think it's getting any better now with this website. We don't really know how people would vote if we were allowed to vote on abortion, but polls going back to Roe v. Wade show that a huge majority, substantial majority, 70% oppose abortion at least after the first trimester and support reasonable restrictions like parental notification and spousal notification. So our issues are conservative. The social issues tend to be more popular than, say, raising the age of Social Security, the fiscal type issues that we're told are so popular. I'd like them both. I'm a conservative across the board. So I sort of feel the pain of Tea Partiers in being harangued, or the conservative side of the ledger, in being harangued all this time and accused of being the ones responsible for losses. But at the same time, I do think Republicans should stop the circular firing squad, and most importantly, stop primarying our own guys. As long as we're still a minority in the Senate, let's get a big veto-proof majority in the Senate, and then purge the impure Republicans.
You won a campaign against an incumbent Republican, Mitch McConnell, obviously a big name. Is he somebody you would like to see a challenge against now, or maybe when you have a safer majority?
Never. And I'm so glad you mentioned this. I've been arguing with talk radio host after talk radio host. I was just on for about an hour with Jay Severin. And I said, look, I will give you facts. And that is something I insist upon in chapter 2 of my book, Advice to Republicans. We're not liberals. We don't engage in groupthink and mobthink and use shibboleths like, you know, Halliburton. But I just keep hearing Mitch McConnell is a rhino. I'll give you facts why he's a conservative and why I support him. One quick one is, he was the Ted Cruz against campaign finance reform. I think he's the best Republican leader in the Senate we've had in my lifetime. It's not an easy job. You have to represent the entire spectrum of Republicans. Now, please give me facts why I should oppose him. He's also voted the same as Rand Paul, you know, the majorly upgraded Tea Party candidate from Kentucky. So why is Rand Paul, oh, we love him, but we hate Mitch McConnell? It just seems to be the same sort of groupthink that liberals normally engage in, not our party. For an hour, nobody could give me a fact on Mitch McConnell. I've put it out there on Twitter. I've said it on talk radio. I'm perfectly willing to say, yes, someday we might want to primary him. Not right now. I'd say that about Lamar Alexander. I would definitely say that about Lindsey Graham. But what is it they don't like about Mitch McConnell?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've talked to people on the left in the Democratic Party who say, why can't we stop sniping at each other? Why can't we be unified like the Republicans? Is that just something that each side perceives in itself, that we're fragmented, the other side is this monolith?
I think it is delusional for the Democrats to think they're fragmented. I keep asking the few liberal and Democratic friends I have, how did you guys get your party to stop that? Your base is much crazier than ours is. And they say it was probably, well, some say it was through losing all the time that they finally got together. I mean, why isn't Emily's List or NARAL for America down protesting Mark Pryor in Arkansas, pro-life, pro-Iraq war Democrat, or Bob Casey, pro-life senator from Pennsylvania? Somehow they get their base to understand, no, it's better to have a guy with a D after his name, even if he's not, you know, down the line liberal on everything. Conservatives, I think, haven't learned that, and I hope we don't have to go through another election cycle where we are giving up easy pickup seats for us, like Claire McCaskill in Missouri ran against Todd Akin, admittedly. McCaskill, this is how the Democrats are much cleverer. She contributed to Todd Akin being the one to win that primary, recognizing that he'd be the easiest for her to beat. And her campaign, the New York Times has written this up, her campaign manager said, okay, let's put out a bunch of ads right before the primary describing Todd Akin as the most conservative. And that helped push him over the edge. He was clearly a disaster. If we were the Democratic Party, there would have been an unfortunate hunting accident to get rid of that guy. It's crazy that we gave up a seat in conservative Missouri. It's crazy that Republicans right now aren't thinking about flipping seats that are Democrat now in conservative red states rather than trying to purify our own.
Well, a big part of your book, as you mentioned, is giving advice to Republicans on winning elections. Let's talk about Karl Rove and the 2012 election. Do you think he messed up? Do you think he hurt the party?
I think political consultants are a big problem, and I describe it generally as people who hurt the Republican Party to help themselves, generally with consultants, what they're interested in. I don't write specifically about Rove because I just think it gets too wonky, and a lot of people have written about it. But the cases, I think, that are the strongest, that ought to be the clearest to right-wingers, are the two Senate seats and at least one, maybe two Senate seats, lost in Connecticut and West Virginia by consultants who just wanted the deep-pocketed candidate so they could go buy Jaguars rather than running a candidate who could possibly win. And Linda McMahon, I mean, God bless her for spending so much of her own money in two Senate races in Connecticut. But I was screaming from the rooftops. I was writing columns. She's never going to win in Connecticut. Please, please, Republicans, do not pick her. But she has consultants who are pushing her through the primary. They have to have known she could not have won in Connecticut. I know. John Racy, same thing, very, very wealthy man. He has houses in West Virginia, Telluride and Palm Beach. People in West Virginia thought he's not one of us, and the campaign consultants thought, I'm going to shop for a vacation home if we run this guy. Those are at least two Senate seats, I would say, in Virginia. That's a very conservative state. We shouldn't be losing that Senate races in that state, and at least one in Connecticut, another three Senate seats right there. The problem with the consultants are they want to maximize their earnings not only by running the wrong candidates, but also by running the wrong sort of campaign. This gets more to the Rove issue, and that is by spending lots and lots of money on television ads when what you need is activism and people and phone banks. But the consultants don't make money off volunteers. They make money off TV ads.
I want to talk about the presidential standard bearers and who you might look for in 2016. Mitt Romney, John McCain, good choices?
McCain was an utter disaster. You may or may not recall I was not only dead set opposed to him, I supported Hillary over John McCain.
I kind of knew the answer, yeah.
I think I was right. Whereas Romney, I mean, this is like a Mitch McConnell problem. People just calling him a rhino without looking at the facts. He was one of the most conservative and I think most respectable, impressive presidential candidates the Republicans have run. Just because someone wears a nice suit and speaks well does not make him a rhino.
We're talking to Ann Coulter, conservative columnist, author of the new book, Never Trust a Liberal Over Three, Especially a Republican.
Now we'll check the headlines and then we'll be back with more from Ann Coulter. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with conservative author and columnist Ann Coulter. Her latest book is called Never Trust a Liberal Over Three, Especially a Republican.
Well, Ann, turning away from electoral politics, you recently did an Ask Me Anything on the new media site Reddit. What was the response like to an open source Ask Ann Coulter Anything?
Lots of questions. I tried to get through all the ones I could, except the ones that were like six paragraphs long.
A lot of preamble.
That's too much to read for a quick answer. Yeah, and it was fun. I liked it.
One of the questions was, and you mentioned this earlier, why you oppose gay marriage? You responded, you mostly oppose gay divorce. What did you mean by that?
That was just a joke.
Oh, okay. And actually, I wanted to ask you about the joke thing. You tell a lot of jokes on the talk shows, during speeches. But, you know, you came from a law school background, worked as a lawyer, Center for Individual Rights. When did you start incorporating humor into your political writing, your political talking?
No one's ever asked me that. Actually, always. It would get edited out of court opinions. When I was clerking, and when I first started writing, I was writing for Human Events. I don't even think you could find these columns. This was back in, I think I started January 1997. I'd left the Senate Judiciary Committee then. I was working for MSNBC and writing for Human Events. And their editing technique, which I pointed out to them and complained about, was to go through and systematically remove every joke. And I told them, you know, if you just do that, for one thing, often the sentence before has no real point other than as a setup for the joke. And also, I mean, that's what leavens some of the hyperbole, to throw in a joke here and there. You take the jokes out, it sounds like I'm just, you know, it's just crusading anger. But really all that happened is editors became more compliant with letting me keep the jokes in.
And the jokes, though, sometimes get an angry action. Sometimes you mentioned, you know, if this was a Democrat, the candidate would have had a hunting accident. Do you think people take things out of context, or maybe are they right to challenge you on some of the more out there joke lines?
I maintain that through a horrible medical accident in the 60s and 70s. Some children were born with a procedure and had a procedure that removed a sense of irony from them, and they still walk among us, and it's just sad. There's nothing you can do. You say to them, hot enough for you? What do you mean hot? I hate it this hot. No, I was being ironic.
And now, more about reaction to you. People have compared you to a Nazi. People have asked you to sign copies of Mein Kampf as a protest at book signings. You're known for riling people up. Do you think it ever gets to be too much? Does it offend you? How offended people get with you?
No. I think I'd be embarrassed if that were my response to someone. You mentioned Reddit. Some of the responses there, and also I kind of skim through them. I don't read a lot of the interaction page on my Twitter feed, which is very popular. I generally know when I send one out, which is going to cause a furor, but I don't often go and check to see if I was right. If your best argument is to call me a poopy head, I don't think I'd be doing like a victory dance over that. If you're just using, calling me an effing C word, wow, you sure got me. No, you're the one who looks like an idiot.
Well, the argument is, I guess one argument might be you started it, with some of the book titles you've had, Traitors and things like that. Is it a two-way
treason.
Name-calling street? A treason, I'm sorry, yes.
Treason.
Fair enough, treason, yes.
I don't think so, because usually the ones posting calling me an effing C word are probably not the author of 10, by the way. This one makes it 10.
10 best-selling books. I stand correct. Sit corrected.
Well, you couldn't know. It just happened yesterday.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, here's a response I didn't expect and I didn't know going into this. You have a popularity of following in the gay community. You were named the conservative gay group Go Proud's gay icon. You've been called the right-wing Judy Garland. I think we've heard that you've called yourself that. What's the deal with that?
I have no idea. I just started noticing that my book signings were often turning into, log cabin Republican parties. I suspect it's because we like the same cocktails, the same music, often the same underwear. Gays tend to be ironic. They certainly never pout and say that's not funny. That's more of a feminist thing.
You've mentioned you're not wild about gay marriage. Does it seem weird that you'd get that following?
No, in fact, I was the first speaker at Go Proud, a conservative gay group. And in addition to, starting with a few jokes on Obama and so on, the bulk of my speech was talking them out of gay marriage. I have never failed to talk gays out of gay marriage. In fact, before they asked me to be their speaker, out in L.A., I have a lot of gay friends. And, most of them admit to you quietly, yeah, I don't really care about gay marriage. One time I told them, okay, I want you to get all your gay friends together. We're going out. I'm talking any remaining ones out of gay marriage. And I've never failed to, because for one thing, they don't really care about gay marriage. It's more of a feeling of acceptance. And my point is, no, we love gays. We do not want discrimination against gays. And by the way, Republicans have been at the forefront of pushing job discrimination laws, that sort of thing for gays. This has nothing to do with gays per se. It's a defense of a crucial institution that has been under attack from every angle, with the feminists pushing for no-fault divorce, with liberals pushing welfare programs that discourage marriage. It's interesting. The group of people, the community most opposed to gay marriage are black people, and I think that's because they have seen the effects of a lack of marriage within the black community. You get a lot of, single mothers, children raised without fathers, and that is the source of all dysfunction, as described in my book, Guilty.
When you say that gay people you've talked to don't really care that much about gay marriage, do you reckon that's a representative sample? There's a lot of people who have been making the argument to the contrary.
It varies, but I do think a lot of it comes from the being told over and over again, this is a civil right. If people like you, they will give you gay marriage. And the important point to express is, no, we love you. This isn't about you. It's about marriage. Marriage is really under attack from all angles. And look, I'm in the same boat. I'm not married. I'm 120 years old. There are lots of advantages to being a married person. I am fine with that because the institution of marriage as a cradle to pass civilization on from one generation to the next, that is so crucially important.
Right. We've got a comment from John on Facebook. I don't know if you've seen an article. He says, what's your response to a recent article on Salon hypothesizing that she and you are carrying out an Andy Kaufman-esque satire of politics in your career?
Oh, I didn't see that. That is a claim that has dogged me from the beginning. I don't know why liberals find it comforting to say, I mean, I'm gathering what this means is, oh, you don't really believe it.
I think that's the gist, yeah.
They say that to me as well as other conservatives they find threatening or can't answer. I don't really know why that should be so comforting. If I'm saying something I don't believe, it's weird how persuasive and how many fans I have. That would suggest that the liberal argument is even worse than I thought, that even someone faking it as a conservative can be so persuasive.
All right, and just a couple minutes left, I'd like to play lightning round with a few things in the news these days, if that's okay with you.
Sure, I'm kind of slow, though.
All right, NSA spying on our allies, France and Germany, among others, in the European Union. Your thoughts?
I always sort of assumed it was happening, but wow, the extent of it now, it really is quite alarming.
All right,
I'm more worried about them spying on me, though I'd tell them anything I have to say anyway.
All right. Our governor, Scott Walker, talked about as a possible presidential candidate. What do you think?
Oh, I like him. I thought he was short, and I found out that he's not, so he should definitely be in the running.
Because he's not short.
Right. I mean, I know it's unfair, but it's not my rule. It's just true. We're not going to elect a president that is extremely short, that who has facial hair, no facial hair either. We're not in the 1700s.
No hipsters. Okay.
Well, they can be hip, but they can't have facial hair. What else? Probably no one extremely corpulent. But somebody told me he actually, I don't know why I thought he was short. Someone told me he's not short. He is a governor of a big, important state. So definitely he should be in our primaries if he wants to run.
Paul Ryan, vice presidential candidate, congressman from Wisconsin, another possible contender.
No congressmen, only senators and governors. No one who lost a debate to Joe Biden. And finally, absolutely no one who supports amnesty.
All right. Maybe you'll have the same response. We'll leave our state Chris Christie as a possible candidate.
That's when I dumped him. And since I was the last right-winger defending him, I am dubious about his prospects. I mean, I'd forgive him for a lot, being in a liberal state like New Jersey, and he's so charismatic, and he is very bright, and he's about to win a massive reelection in a blue state. He's a governor. I'm sure he's going to run. But I can't understand why Republicans can't just say, just because Democrats need another 30 million voters isn't a good enough reason for us to give amnesty to lawbreakers.
All right, Anne, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Great to talk to you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
That was Anne Coulter. Her newest book, Never Trust a Liberal Over 3, Especially a Republican.
The news from NPR is next, and then we'll talk about the increasing tensions between the U.S. and leaders around the world over phone tapping by the NSA. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Walking with the nut that you